From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this the stuff they don't want you to know. It is the top of the week. We are returning to you with a bevy of strange, fascinating, dare we say, disturbing pieces of news, not all of which make it to the mainstream. We're talking corruption. We're talking DNA and quite possibly future crimes. Shout out Minority Report. And then we're also talking about some amazing, beautiful stuff that machine consciousness, machine learning, and AI can do, as well as their newly discovered talent for creating weaponry that is beyond the ken of mortal minds. So that's going to come back to bite us later.
It's going to fill all of our pants
with poop. Yes, that's the goal. That's the first synthetic mind's main goal. It's very poop-centric. No one's sure why. They think it's a bug in the program, but, you know, we got this far. So everybody be safe with your pants around computers. That is the takeaway.
I've got a solution. No pants. Eh?
Well, that's easier than no computers these days.
I'm saying if you're not wearing pants, then there's nothing for the computers to fill, but then you just end up pooping on the floor. So,
or you might have to walk around with one of those traditional penis gourds. If you ever seen those in documentaries,
I don't know what this is, Ben. Is that a thing that rock stars use to stuff their pants?
It's like a cylindrical tube that covers the non-scrotum part of male genitalia. You know what? We don't have to get into it.
We're really leading with the good stuff today, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah. You could discover that. I think you could go on your own journey with that, with penis sheaths and gourds. They're also known as Koteka, K-O-T-E-K-A. So,
wow.
Yeah, Koteka. If you want to ruin your search history the way we just did, then the more the merrier. They can't catch us all, right?
It's just slightly off from Kotaku. But seriously, you guys, as a thought experiment, imagine how effective that would be if whatever nefarious AI comes about, if it could somehow simultaneously make all humans go to the bathroom on themselves, like the time that you would get in that moment of everyone having to deal with that situation.
Mm-hmm. Is this a brown note situation?
It would have to invent a real brown note. And they're like, whomever the Jedis of your pants are, would be like, there's a disturbance in the fart.
I just have to say, I'm really proud of the legacy I've left behind of the brown note. Few people know this, but that is a family name. My grandfather, Wolfgang Braun, Wolfgang von Braun is the one who actually invented the brown note.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. Wow. So that's on you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we learn more about each other every day, not just as friends, but as civilizations. And one of our first stories today, I think we go ahead and lead with this one if everyone's all right with it. We're going to talk about something that is potentially very dangerous. We've talked in the past about facial recognition. We've talked about profiling. We've talked about the enormous power of DNA databases. And when we talk about big data, one of the holy grails of these pursuits and these disciplines and these areas of research is to arrive at not just an analytical aptitude, but to arrive at a predictive aptitude. And this is something that is happening in many fields in the world of medicine, for instance, predicting the possibility of contracting dangerous, rare genetic conditions. But there's a dark side to this, and Matt, you pointed out something that should concern our good friends and fellow conspiracy realists in Australia.
Yes, very much so. And I'm getting this from The Guardian. In an article titled "How Australian Police Will Use DNA Sequencing to Predict What Suspects Look Like."
Oh boy.
Okay.
What could go wrong?
What could go wrong? So we've talked extensively on this show about forensic genealogy, the thing that you may know from GEDmatch, the service, and the DNA sequencing type, let's say, and genealogy usage that caught the Golden State Killer, that has been used many times over the past, I guess, 5 years or so to catch killers who were thought to not be catchable because the DNA was either not good enough to fully identify someone. You know, there wasn't a good enough sample to fully identify someone with traditional standard DNA testing and sequencing, or there was just no person that it matched to. So they were able to use forensic genealogy to match that DNA to, you know, some cousin or family member or someone, and then, you know, using other investigative techniques, decide, oh, this is our suspect, this is our person. Well, this thing is very different. Imagine, again, we're all investigators. We go on a crime scene. We find an excellent DNA sample, let's say blood, and we're able to take that sample back and get it tested. But as we're, you know, we've got it sequenced, we know that this suspect is this DNA. It's not matching any database that exists, including the GEDmatch one that we would use for forensic genealogy. It's not matching, you know, any of the crime databases, any of the state or federal databases. This person, again, we know who they are, but they just don't exist in the system. What do you do? Well, in this new fun thing, I've seen it referred to as massively parallel sequencing. You'll see it named a couple of different things around the interwebs here. But in this case, you're able to look at very specific markers and enough of them, and then match those markers together and compare and contrast to see whether or not a person has, let's say, brown eyes or greenish blue eyes,
okay,
or if their hair color naturally is a light brown or maybe blonde or red. And you're able to tell several different physical characteristics about this person just through this DNA sample. And the reason I wanted to bring it to, you know, our discussion today is because of, again, we keep talking about the possible dangers that exist here. Because, I mean, let's just start talking about it. You guys, what do you see as a potential downside to the ability to do this?
Ooh, okay. I like that we're setting this up. I feel like I'm almost on a game show about how terrible the future is going to be. Sorry, I'm trying to be more optimistic. I'm just mixed results, guys. So one of the things that would be dangerous would depend on what kind of profile this can make based solely on appearance, because you could have a green-eyed, red-haired, the freckly person with like attached earlobes instead of detached earlobes. And then you could
Are you describing me, Ben?
Okay. Well, you could have somebody who's, I don't know. I don't know your earlobes. I'm sorry. I'm a bad friend. We're always wearing headphones. Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Nice earlobes.
That's a good point. I feel
creepy saying that. But the point is that there could be someone, I would imagine, who physically fits all of that criteria, but has nothing to do with the crime in question. Is that a possibility?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It would then be a process of extracting a DNA sample from that person and, you know, getting maybe a warrant to do so if that person happened to be in the area and was caught on CCTV or something, right, around the time of the crime.
Or just going through their trash. Which happened.
I mean, you know, this is like, it's not quite like, it's not pre-crime, you know, like in Minority Report or some other kind of weird dystopian versions of how do we use science to predict who will, you know, commit crimes. There's a really cool anime where they have a gun that essentially, it doesn't tell the future, but it uses these types of markers to analyze the potential psychological profile of a suspect and engages the gun or does not, depending on the results of that scan, right? So you start to veer into weird territories like that once, like, if we trust this stuff so implicitly that we would be comfortable executing someone who matches these, you know, DNA markers of a certain crime. That's sort of the next level version of where the slippery slope on this kind of thing might lead, right?
Yeah.
It's one of, but I mean, in and of itself, is it that far removed for just like using kind of shitty CCTV footage or just like word of mouth? I mean, it ultimately is still profiling, right? You can't, it's just a little bit of a fancier version of like an identikit, you know, which is like a artist rendering, you know, of a suspect.
Yeah. In a weird way, this does feel a lot like that. A victim or someone, you know, witness telling someone in on the police department what this person looks like. In this case, it's the DNA telling the police department or FBI or whoever what the suspect looks like. One of the major problems, though, is wigs exist. Facial hair can be changed. Mm-hmm. You know, one can change one's skin to an extent, you know, either through getting a tan or by wearing certain makeups. Eye color. Think about putting in contacts. Like if you're looking for someone like this, like physically searching for someone who matches a description like this, not only can your suspect change their appearance, but now you're going to be seeing hundreds, if not thousands of people who possibly look like your suspect. And it's just the nature of humans. And we kind of look like each other.
Is there nothing in the, you know, obviously this is some department's or, you know, some forward thinking department head's idea of like a cool new initiative. What's their justification for this?
Justification is that.
How would they argue with the points that we're making, or do they even bother? Because that is, to me, it doesn't feel that much more advanced or different than just saying a suspect with blue eyes and blonde hair wearing a red. I mean, clothing would be more helpful than this DNA stuff because you can see it from farther off. You know, I'm just wondering what's the press release elevator pitch for this? That is the wave of the future. You know?
Oh, I mean, yeah, it is a wave of the future, and it could be extremely helpful if you're trying to narrow down suspects, right? If you had a certain number of people as possibles who were, you know, culpable for a crime, and you can definitely put that person in that room wherever it happened, right? And you can say, oh, the person definitely has green or blue eyes, like for sure. The person due to their DNA has green or blue eyes, so we can get rid of these three people. It's like, guess who?
But do we really trust this to be scaled properly, knowing what kind of backlog of like rape kits exist in the world? Like how hard it is to get labs to turn around this kind of stuff in a timely manner?
I mean, I don't think so.
I don't. But that's I just mean,
really, that's one of the main reasons I want to talk about it because of this. The problems. But the thing is, it could be really great. There are a ton of ethical concerns, though. And that really is what we're talking about here today. In the Guardian article, the whole last fourth of the article is dedicated to this very topic. And again, it's, I don't know, it's worth looking into more. It's going to be tested out in Australia by law enforcement there. So I guess we'll see over the next 5-10 years, whether or not this thing is actually used, whether it's actually helpful, and what other, you know, what kinds of problems it brings up with its, mm-hmm. you know, what gets lost in execution.
So how are they planning to implement it, Matt? From what I understand in the Guardian article, at least, they're going to start using this in not necessarily a crime solving way, as in they're not finding the culprits of crime, but they're looking at unidentified human remains, right? And then maybe they can build a rough composite picture of someone, and then the hope being that relatives can find closure or identify the person. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's one of the uses of it. You can also head over to the Brisbane Times, Brisbane Times. You can read an article there titled "Next Level of DNA Analysis Allows Police to Build Picture of Suspects." Same pretty much information, a couple different quotes that are in here. And Ben, just to answer your question, I did see that in a couple places, including that Guardian article and in this place, they're talking about exactly that. Getting a picture, but not for a suspect, for unidentified remains. There was one article that I cannot repeat to you right now. Oh, gosh. I think
Does it have naughty words in the name or something? Or?
No, I think it was in Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News. And it was titled "Cold Cases Heat Up with New Forensic DNA Methods." And it was posted, gosh, I think a while ago. But it describes a person that was hiking along the Appalachian Trail who was using an assumed name, or, you know, a fake name for their hiking name,
sure.
Their trail name.
Yeah.
And this person was older and was ill and died along the trail. And this seemed to be a test case where you could, because nobody could identify this person. Nobody knew who they were, and they had been out there for a while, but they had DNA. So they're able to take that DNA and build a picture of what this person probably looked like while they were walking around and alive. So hopefully someone can identify them. Their name was Ben, by the way.
Oh, good. Great. Yeah. Well, go Bens for the most part. But also, you know, that it's a bit of a pickle, isn't it? Because there's no denying that that could be incredibly helpful in a lot of similar cases. But we shouldn't get so wrapped up in the advantages or potential benefits of that that we forget there is a dark side, with as with any technology. It reminds me a bit about how some increasingly draconian internet surveillance laws often come sort of messaged as a way to stop heinous crimes that everybody would be against, you know, like child trafficking or something. But on the back end, the bigger goal for a lot of institutions is to restrict or erode privacy. I don't know. There's also another thing we haven't mentioned, man, which is that this kind of research is inevitable. It's on the way. It's going to be weird if civilization doesn't collapse between the time a child is born now and the time that child reaches 18. We're going to be living in a world where it's weird not to have your DNA sequenced. And it'll be I don't think it'll necessarily be a top-down government mandate so much as it'll be, again, the Gattaca approach. Like it in countries mm-hmm. that suffer under privatized healthcare, you might have to have that sequencing just to be able to see a doctor.
But also, like, wouldn't it largely be a benefit to the more affluent classes, you know, like who could maybe make the choices and pay the money to get their offspring's gene sequenced such that they are not predisposed to like certain types of cancer or certain types of disease? And then the rest of us are kind of stuck with the lot that we're dealt.
Absolutely. I mean, that's also that becomes a matter of policy, too. Like the question then becomes, should a government or state level actor, should it consider it a human right to just proactively prevent someone from having a very damaging medical condition? Or are you putting parents and a future human in a situation where they say, okay, we could have cured your, you know, insert genetic condition here, and we know you're definitely going to get it if we don't do anything, but you didn't make your payments. So your child's life is ruined.
Yep.
Over coupons.
Yeah. I've got one last scenario for you, and I know we got to move on to the next segment. What if it's the ultra wealthy in your scenarios here, guys, that instead of wanting to get themselves sequenced or maybe just not worrying so much about that, they want to get everyone else sequenced so they can know exactly who robbed them or who is mm-hmm. cheating them on the workers' line,
like a more elaborate version of hiring a private detective or something, or like mm-hmm. you know, like a really bespoke genetic private detective.
Maybe they set up incentives, or you know, with either a carrot or a stick, to make sure everybody gets their genes sequenced so that they can identify everybody if anyone falls out of line.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then also, we haven't talked about this because this is still a little further down the line, but this occurs in a lot of works of fiction and sci-fi. Also, this could potentially, down the road, open the door for bespoke, genetically tailored biowarfare. I mean, that's just something we have to acknowledge. I don't believe the technology is there at this scale yet, but the truth of the matter is, of the almost 8 billion people in the world, a lot are pills, you know, they're real jerks. And it would make their day to say, here is a deadly pathogen that I can tailor such that it only affects the people in my society or the people on this planet that I don't care for. And then, boom, unless some kind of cure or countermeasure is developed, a lot of people would die. Perhaps more easily than most other diseases or pandemics before. Again, I don't want to alarm people, but it's in the cards. You know what I mean?
It's in the cards. It's in the DNA.
There it is.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
So look up massive parallel sequencing if you want to learn more. There's a lot you can learn all over the place. Check out those articles I mentioned. And if you've got any stories to tell about any of that stuff, we'd love to hear from you. We'll tell you how to contact us at the end of this episode. For now, we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
So we're back. Let's stick with the future just for a bit. Machine consciousness, artificial intelligence. There are no shortages of very important debates about this. There's no shortage of profoundly impactful research going on. And, you know, one of the biggest debates is around anthropocentrism, the idea that by nature of existing, humans are somehow the main character of the story of life and evolution and everything else. You know, we talked about this a long time ago, but I think it's quite possible that the role of the human species is simply a kind of doula or a midwife, meaning that ultimately the best thing or the most important thing that humanity can do is to create a species or a kind of life form that is capable of exploring the galaxy, that is capable of cooperation on a scale that humans just don't seem to be capable of. We also had a great discussion a while back about AI-generated scripts, stories, films, movies, songs, and pornography, if I recall. And the idea was like, ultimately, AI will just be, or machine consciousness will just be making this for itself or other forms of itself, and humans won't really be an important demographic in the audience. We're starting to see, as a species, we're starting to see the rubber hit the road in this regard. We already knew that computers that maybe weren't quite AI, but were supercomputers or had machine learning capabilities, we know that they have advanced science at an unparalleled pace. And we knew that at some point we would get to the edge of the event horizon, you know, for lack of a better word. We would get to the precipice of human understanding. And so now I want to give the choice to you guys. Matt, Noel, do you want the good news or bad news first? I have two examples of what's happening.
Can we go with maths?
Okay. All right.
We'll go with the I don't know if that's the good news or the bad news, but I like the word maths. So
It's the good news. It's the good news. So the good news is this. Artificial intelligence is discovering patterns in math that have never been seen before throughout the entirety of the human experience. No one, maybe somebody could have figured this stuff out, but the computer mind beat the meatbags to it. Science Alert had a great article that came out a few days ago by an author named David Neild, who noted that now we can, as a society, officially confirm that artificial intelligence is capable of not just proving mathematical theorems. You know, there are mathematical theorems that have yet to be conclusively proven, but it can now suggest, it can conceive of mathematical theorems. Like it can think of the question to ask, if that makes sense.
Now, that is very counter to the ideas that Ada Lovelace put out, which was that a computer could only operate. Ada Lovelace being someone Ben and I have talked about on Ridiculous History, and it's come up, she's come up on this show plenty of times, but that computers can only operate based on instructions programmed into them by humans. So this is not that, right? But this is saying it can, a computer, an AI, can actually come up with a theorem it's on its own or solve a theorem without being exactly guided through, or
that's the edge of what we're getting at too. So mathematicians have been using computers to solve or discover patterns for decades and decades, and for a long time people have taken the Lovelace stance on current machine learning or AI, which is this, that yes, AI can solve problems that are too complex for humans, but you still need a human behind the cognitive wheel to define what the problem is and to define, like, ballpark what a solution would look like. That's like what they're saying is, like, without a human being, there's not a framework right? There's not a context. And this may not always be the case for now. So what we found is that computers are helping humans now formulate conjectures or suggest what they call possible lines of attack for unproven ideas in math. This also comes to us, by the way, from the University of Sydney in Australia. Australian listeners, you're featuring very heavy in this week's segment. And that was a quote from mathematician Jordy Williamson. This research demonstrates something called a supervised learning tool. And without getting too deep in the mathematical weeds, we are not pure mathematicians or studying mathematicians. What we can say is that this model, this application, this approach, this robotic mind or near electronic mind was able to discover a previously unknown relationship between two different types of mathematical knots, which led to a new theorem. They came up with a new idea about how the world works. And this can't be overstated. This is a benefit, this kind of pattern recognition, this kind of compare and contrast. It is enormously helpful to working human mathematicians. So that's the good news. And we will only see this trend accelerate. And you can understand why that might not get reported in a bunch of places, because math is a snooze fest for a lot of people. So we'll give you, you know, we gave you some salve for the future, but let's close with some shock. It's time for the bad news. Doc, can we get some like bad news music? Perfect. Artificial intelligence is not just able to put mathematicians in a John Henry moment. Now we have for the first time confirmed in China that artificial intelligence is able to build futuristic weapons. At a level that humans may have been theoretically aware of, but not quite capable of creating. To be clear, the Chinese military and the U.S. military and any military that can afford it are already using some version of AI to build very powerful sci-fi stuff like railguns. Railguns are so cool. They can fire projectiles over hundreds of miles. But now an AI program has built what's called a coil gun. Have you guys heard of coil guns before?
No, I know rail gun, but that's right. Not what this is.
A rail gun is like almost like it shoots. I'm thinking of like the guns from like the Doom games. Wasn't that one of those? What is a coil gun? Is it some sort of energy weapon?
Yeah, a coil gun is similar to a rail gun. And you could say it is a kind of energy weapon because it uses electromagnetic energy. Coil guns are a little bit distinct from rail guns because of the direction of acceleration in a rail gun versus a coil gun. But the main thing you need to know is that a coil gun is a little more dangerous because it can be soaked in polymer and fired underwater. And wow. A rail gun cannot because it needs direct current going through the rails. This should be a little bit scary because here's what it specifically invented. Like, we know one of the drawbacks from railguns for a long time was the size, right? How do we miniaturize this? How do we get it to something that could be useful outside of a lab or a field test on a fake on a fake aircraft carrier, right? In the middle of nowhere in China. They built one with the help of AI. These researchers built a coil gun that is the size of a handheld firearm. It is the size of a pistol. They built a future zapper. It's got a 4.5-inch barrel, and it has three battery-powered coils that create an electromagnetic field, and this means the bullet doesn't touch the sides of the barrel as it passes through. Its kinetic energy reaches almost 150 joules, which, just if you're keeping notes at home, that's more than twice the energy needed to fire a fatal shot. Wow. Yeah, the bullet speed can vary depending on, you know, the caliber, size of weight, etc. But this also means you can adjust the coil gun. So let's say you are in an authoritarian country and you're suppressing a protest on the anniversary of the death of some great revolutionary who was hanged in the public square or shot. Well, then if you're the police force, this means that you can use a coil gun, and you can dial up or dial down the energy of the projectiles you're firing. So it's not quite like zapping. It's not quite a Star Trek phaser. It still is a ballistic weapon. Like, it's shooting a physical thing at these protesters, but now they can turn it down a little bit and they can turn it up to lethal levels, which also, I just want to open the door here. That also means that someone could say, oh, I didn't know it was set at, I thought it was set for stun, for lack of a better word, you know? So that death can't be on me.
Dude, I got a little carried away looking at coil guns because it's a brand new concept for me. It's absolutely astonishing. Looking at some of the previous uses for this technology that NASA wanted to explore, I guess, with launching things into space and launching things from the moon back to Earth, this is crazy. I never thought about this. Using essentially railgun technology, but with a specific design to launch things with enough force to get out of the atmosphere. And now I'm imagining AI like getting involved with like stuff at that scale.
Yes. That's where it should be. That's where it should be pointed instead of creating these sorts of firearms, debatably. But also we got to point out, like, all right, why AI? What do they do exactly? Well, they figured out things that humans cannot figure out. They figured out very, very tiny, minuscule differences in the shape of a coil or the size can make a huge impact on its performance. And the battery in these kinds of guns can also have a huge effect. And then you have to contemplate the design of the bullet, the design of the barrel. All of these factors made the handheld coil gun just beyond the scope of traditional weapons software. But what the AI programs have done, and this is, by the way, coming from a paper published in Transactions of the China Electrotechnical Society last month. And what they found is not only a new type of weapon, but they've also found a precedent. And to understand that precedent, we'll talk just a little bit about what the AI is doing that humans weren't. This AI could start with an imperfect design and game out tons of possible improvements over and over, more and more iterations, keeping the stuff that worked and tossing aside the stuff that it knew wouldn't work. It could learn from its previous mistakes. And then it would give human designers a huge set, like a data set of information, like, here's how you build a future gun. And we'd be like, thank you, robot overlord. We'll make sure to do, human stuff with it. And humans do have a history, a bit of a reputation when it comes to firearm technology. So we know what it's going to be used for. I wish it was being used to expand space travel, and that may be the case. But I want to end this on one pretty cool note. I know that this is for some of this is for a particular set of people in our crowd today, and I didn't know if you guys were aware of this. I wasn't aware, but to my good friend Flavored Meal Substance on Instagram, dude, you can buy a coil gun, the US GR1 Anvil from Arc Flash Labs. That's the one you want to get. And if you look at the South China Morning Post article, where I'm pulling some of this firearm information, I just posted it in the chat. If you scroll down, you can see the anvil itself. And it looks kind of like a Nerf gun.
Yep. They call it a Gauss rifle.
Yes.
I've seen them called that in video games, too. I immediately brought up Quake and Doom because that's kind of where I always originally heard the term railgun. And then I confused it with a nail gun, of course, because that also was a gun in those games. But they're very popular in like games like Gears of War and I think even in Fortnite and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. You can buy this. Again, it is not the same as the robot-designed handheld coil gun, but you also have to sign a waiver when you buy it. There's a little thing on the website for the manufacturer that says full liability waiver must be signed by end user prior to shipment. So before they even send it to you, you're saying, hey, if I die or somebody else dies or something goes sideways, it's officially not your fault. I kind of want to get one. Anyway, we'll pause for a word from our sponsor. Over the break, folks, please, please, please let us know what other improvements, good or bad, you see AI making in the near future. This is only the beginning of a very large wave that is coming at you as we record this today. Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com, 1-833-STD-WYTK. And we'll be right back with one more piece of strange news.
And as promised, we're back with one more piece of strange news. This one comes from the United States of America, and it concerns privacy, but not necessarily your privacy or my privacy. This is specifically the privacy of those who are incarcerated, because as we know, there is such a thing as attorney-client privilege. That information is not supposed to be admissible in court proceedings, and when you enter into a conversation with your attorney, it's supposed to be, you know, sacrosanct, like a confession to a priest or something. But I think even confessions or like client patient privilege, like with a therapist, there are rules where if you think someone is going to do something, you are supposed to, you know, tell somebody, tell the authorities. But I believe, you know, the idea of speaking to your attorney, it's not meant to be listened to, even though some other telephone calls from, you know, prisons are monitored, personal phone calls. These calls between an incarcerated person and their attorney are not supposed to be being the operating word here. But we have found out recently that this has not been the case, and there is one company that services prison telephone systems across the country that is at the heart of this scandal. The story starts in Brooklyn, New York, and this comes from an article in Vice that I got hip to the story by Ella Fassler. That goes into this whole thing, but let's start from the beginning. In Brooklyn, a organization called Brooklyn Defender Services believed that phone calls of many of their clients, this is an advocacy type group, that believed that many of their clients' phone calls with their lawyers were in fact being recorded. And we know that these are protected under things like the Sixth Amendment and the Federal Wiretap Act. But this organization was very distrustful of the system in Brooklyn, the phone system that was being used. And they called for an audit of these phone calls and which ones were being recorded. Again, personal ones, totally permissible. The lawyer ones, not supposed to be recorded. So Elizabeth Daniel Vasquez, who's the director of the Science and Surveillance Project at Brooklyn Defender Services, told Vice's motherboard that there was a general sense of unease around this time. And around 2019, defense attorneys learned that prosecutors had handed over attorney-client phone call recordings during the period of the trial called discovery, where, you know, evidence is exchanged and admitted or not admitted into evidence, the official record. Apparently, though, these phone recordings of these very privileged calls, some of them were given exceptions and entered into to discovery. After quite a few more of these calls surfaced, Brooklyn Defender Services Civil Rights Council, a woman named Brooke Menschel, went to the Department of Corrections, who assured her that no, we fixed all the problems. There's no issue here, nothing to see here. So the Brooklyn Defender Services demanded they do an audit. And from that audit, they discovered that more than 1,500 of these protected phone calls had been recorded. And this is something that would have affected around 350 cases. And this has been reported from the New York Daily News, and the New York Post has done some reporting on this as well. And at the heart of this is a company called Securus, LOL, Technologies, and their inability to distinguish between these personal calls and these private attorney-client calls. So, yeah, they uncovered 1,500 of these protected calls being recorded. And apparently, this is just the tip of the iceberg, as Vice reports. Another advocacy organization, Worth Rises, and also Motherboard that did some analysis of court documents and local news articles secure us apparently, allegedly, has recorded tens of thousands of phone calls between attorneys and their incarcerated clients in seven other states. And this is based on lawsuits that have been filed and other reports from California, Kansas, Louisiana, Maine, Missouri, Texas, Wisconsin. And that is all just SecureUS. Another prison, you know, telecom company, I guess, called Global Tel Link, GTL, allegedly has recorded phone calls with attorneys in Florida, California, and Maine as well. So not a good look. And this is definitely an ongoing story. SecureUS, you know, was reached out to by these organizations and by Vice. And this is what they said in response to Motherboard's request for a comment. Quote, the occasional inadvertent recordings are not evidence of a systemic practice. In fact, it is quite the opposite. Issues involving the inadvertent recording of calls to attorney numbers involve less than 0.1% of all calls on the SecureUS platform, demonstrating that these issues are rare and occasional, not systematic.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sorry, officer. This is the first time I ever tried crack. I thought you bought it by the pound.
Mm.
Like, I don't know, man. I mean, I give him the benefit of a doubt, I guess, you guys. But that feels, coupled with how corrupt the prison phone call system is already, any conspiracy realist who's been unfortunate enough to be incarcerated for one reason or another, if you've been in the stir, if you've been locked up for any kind of long amount of time, then you know that in many states, up until the COVID-19 pandemic, there was a lot of inequality because phone calls were incredibly overpriced.
Yeah, right. I was only aware of that because I got locked up one time for a silly thing. It was like a bench warrant that was out for me for a ticket I hadn't paid. But A, it took me forever to get a call, and B, I had to call collect, cause I only had one number memorized and it was like my mom's, and it ended up being incredibly expensive. It was like, you know, $60 or something like that, but that was cause it was collect. But if you're incarcerated, it's a little less than that. But if you think about the frequency of these calls, it adds up. How much are they looking at today, Ben?
The Prison Policy Initiative reported that a 15-minute phone call could cost as much as $24.82. So hashtag, they did the math. If you divide that cost, what you see is it's like $1.65 per minute, which feels like a 900 line at that point, especially when people are in one of the worst times of their life. Luckily, at least in response to the pandemic, back in 2020, April, the Federal Bureau of Prisons did say that, at least in federal pens, telephone and video calls would be free of charge. But I'm just saying that to say, like, if you're aware of that context, I think it's completely understandable how a lot of people would say, okay, I'm sure it's an accident that you happen to listen in. It just seems like rife for corruption. Against a very disadvantaged population. You know what I mean? No matter how they ended up in there, people do have rights.
Really quickly, guys, I don't disagree with everything you're saying. I'm coming at this from the only experience that I have with the SecureUS system. And it was when we were making Atlanta Monster and we were trying to be able to talk to Wayne Williams. Mm-hmm. And we had to go through this ridiculous system of connecting that phone number from which we would be dialing from and receiving calls from, like linking it to our group and to an individual and making sure that that system knew exactly who we were. Right. Mm-hmm. So in response to this Vice article, I think one of the ones that you use for this research, Noel, the company SecureUS is saying, look, if somebody doesn't go through the system and sets up that number to be private or non-recorded, then that phone call is going to get recorded. Like, because they're just default recorded, unless the number is associated with some very
specific
data
set.
Excluded
in some way. Yeah, that makes sense. Now, that makes sense, Matt. That's a really good context. My question is, the one part of this Vice article that kind of threw me, and I need to do a little more digging. This might even be, you know, a larger episode down the line. But, you know, they were saying, these folks from the Brooklyn Defender Services are talking about how client attorney phone calls were submitted in discovery. like, wouldn't those automatically be excluded from being used as evidence? Like, just the fact that it exists doesn't make it legal to use against somebody. I mean, even if the call was recorded, you shouldn't be able to actually submit that or admit that as evidence in a case, right?
Yeah, I think you could. I think that's a good question, because you could, someone could try to use it or try to use some information attained via it that led them to some other evidence. And if they can reasonably rationalize a different avenue toward that evidence, it might get a little tricky. But surely a judge would, if a case makes it to trial, surely a judge would be right in saying this is inadmissible, right?
Right.
Surely.
I guess it would have to be really some dirty dealing to kind of like, you know, hide the chain of custody or like where it actually came from. Because I would think if it was known that it was an illegally recorded phone call, done from prison between a client and their attorney, that would be, you know, a non-starter. Wouldn't you think, Matt, based on your Atlanta Monster stuff as well?
I think so, but I don't know. I don't know, man. Sorry, this whole thing is really disturbing.
It is. It is. But I also am like, does it really matter if they're being recorded, if they're not ending up in the hands of people that would use them nefariously? Is that the implication? Is that the implication that they, of course, are ending up in the hands of people that would use them unfairly? Yeah, please, Matt.
It does. That's why we have a system of trials, right? Each person has a right to defend themselves. And if you're taking counsel with somebody to find a way to defend yourself the most efficiently, no matter whether you did a crime or not, I mean, that's like part of the whole system. I was going to say game, which it is in a weird way a game, but I don't know. At least within our system of laws right now, you got to have that protected communication. And that includes, even if it's just a system that records it by default and it just stays in a file on a hard drive somewhere, right?
That's, it shouldn't exist, right? It shouldn't exist.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
I agree. I agree with you.
Yeah, 100%. I think we're all on the same page. And again, you know, this is not any of us being cheerleaders for crime or what have you. It's just that if you take a larger picture perspective and you think through this, the rights that are guaranteed in theory, again, to people who are incarcerated are enormously important. No matter how they got there, there's a reason that the law exists. Those rights in practice, you know, obviously, they're obviously not holding up to what they're supposed to be in theory. You know, you need look no further than prisons in Scandinavian countries to see the difference in how people treat incarceration. Like, some of those prisons are like better than people's apartments, you know, but still.
Absolutely. They look like those model IKEA apartments, you know, I mean, like really, really clean lines and nice, tasteful decor, you know, comfy mattresses and all that, if a little austere, but nothing like what we see in American prisons, which are, you know, for the long-term stays can be absolutely inhumane. But yeah, I think it's something to keep an eye on. And it's, I'm interested to see where this goes. This is a pretty new story and it is, still developing. But you know, and it's like these types of, prisoner advocacy groups are really important, because left unchecked, either the system won't work like it's supposed to because it's not being checked or like, you know, looked in upon and held to a high standard, or just rampant corruption will absolutely happen in the dark if no one's checking in. So these kind of watchdog groups are incredibly important for, you know, folks' civil rights. I know I'm stating the obvious here, but I'm just saying good work to the folks at Brooklyn Defender Services Organization.
I agree.
But with that, I think we can call this episode of Strange News a wrap. What do you say, fellas?
Agreed. Unless there is an AI overlord that can figure out a better way to end Strange News, we're going to call it a day. Do you own a coil gun? What do you think the dangers of DNA may be, not just in Australia, but around the world? And how far do you think this evidence of either accident or corruption might go in the New York penal system? We would love to hear from you. We try to be easy to find online.
You can find us on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, where we are Conspiracy Stuff. On Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you like this episode, hey, why not give us a review? Apple Podcasts is probably the best, and a review on any other platform would be great too. Please, if you have a moment, go ahead and do that. We really, really, really appreciate it. If you don't want to use social media, and you don't like social media, well, hey, you can also call us. While we're not using Secure Us, we do record every call that comes in.
And we'll play it back on the air with your explicit permission. When you hear the sounds of Ben's dulcet tones at 1-833-STDWYTK, you got 3 minutes to make your recording. Again, completely announced from the very start. Let us know what to call you, or call you nothing. Call you a cool nickname. It can be completely anonymous. It's entirely up to you. And then make sure to let us know if it's okay to use your voice on one of our weekly listener mail episodes. We hope you do.
And if phone calls aren't your thing, if you are scared of speaking to mirrors in the dark or meeting at crossroads at midnight and you don't sip the social meads, have no fear. There is one way you can always contact us, regardless of the inner or outer weather. All you have to do is write us a line, drop us some links, give us some leads. You are the most important part of this show, folks, and we want to hear from you. So why not send us a good old-fashioned email? We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.